He snorted. Don't be stupid. I can take care of myself. I sighed. I also tried to convince him to let you visit. He's prejudiced, so don't let him give you any crap about safety. He knows as well as I do that you'd be safe here. I'll keep that in mind. See you in a few, Jacob said. You're coming up? Yeah. I'm going to get the scent of your visitor so we can track him if he comes back. Jake, I really don't like the idea of you tracking... Oh, please, Bella, he interrupted. Jacob laughed and then hung up. Chapter 10. Scent. It was all very childish. Why on earth should Edward have to leave for Jacob to come over? Weren't we past this kind of immaturity? It's not that I feel any personal antagonism toward him, Bella. It's just easier for both of us, Edward told me at the door. I won't be far away. You'll be safe. I'm not worried about that. He smiled, and then a sly look came into his eye. He pulled me close, burying his face in my hair. I could feel his cool breath saturate the strands as he exhaled. It raised goosebumps on my neck. I'll be right back, he said, and then he laughed aloud as if I just told a good joke. What's so funny? But Edward just grinned and loped off toward the trees without answering. Grumbling to myself, I went to clean up the kitchen. Before I even had the sink full of water, the doorbell rang. It was hard to get used to how much faster Jacob was without his car, how everyone seemed to be so much faster than me. Come in, Jake, I shouted. I was concentrating on piling the dishes into the bubbly water, and I'd forgotten that Jacob moved like a ghost these days, so it made me jump when his voice was suddenly there behind me. Should you really leave your door unlocked like that? Oh, sorry. I'd slopped myself with the dishwater when he'd startled me. I'm not worried about anyone who would be deterred by a locked door, I said, while I wiped the front of my shirt with a dish towel. Good point, he agreed. I turned to look at him, eyeing him critically. Is it really so impossible to wear clothes, Jacob? I asked. Once again, Jacob was bare-chested, wearing nothing but a pair of old cut-off jeans. Secretly, I wondered if he was just so proud of his new muscles that he couldn't stand to cover them up. I had to admit, they were impressive, but I'd never thought of him as vain. I mean, I know you don't get cold anymore, but still. He ran a hand through his wet hair. It was falling in his eyes. It's just easier, he explained. What's easier? He smiled condescendingly. It's enough of a pain to carry the shorts around with me, let alone a complete outfit. What do I look like, a pack mule? I frowned. What are you talking about, Jacob? His expression was superior, like I was missing something obvious. My clothes don't just pop in and out of existence when I change. I have to carry them with me while I run. Pardon me for keeping my burden light. I changed color. I guess I didn't think about that, I muttered. He laughed and pointed to a black leather cord, thin as a strand of yarn, that was wound 3 times below his left calf like an anklet. I hadn't noticed before that his feet were bare, too. That's more than just a fashion statement. It sucks to carry jeans in your mouth. I didn't know what to say to that. He grinned. Does my being half naked bother you? No. Jacob laughed again, and I turned my back on him to focus on the dishes. I hoped he realized my blush was left over from embarrassment at my own stupidity, and had nothing to do with his question. Well, I suppose I should get to work, he sighed. I wouldn't want to give him an excuse to say I'm slacking on my side. Jacob, it's not your job. He raised a hand to cut me off. I'm working on a volunteer basis here. Now where is the intruder scent the worst? My bedroom, I think. His eyes narrowed. He didn't like that any more than Edward had. I'll be just a minute. I methodically scrubbed the plate I was holding. The only sound was the brush's plastic bristles scraping round and round on the ceramic. I listened for something from above, a creak of the floorboard, the click of a door. There was nothing. I realized I'd been cleaning the same plate far longer than necessary, and I tried to pay attention to what I was doing. "Whew," Jacob said, inches behind me, scaring me again. "Yeesh, Jake, cut that out. Sorry." "Here." Jacob took the towel and mopped up my new spill. "I'll make it up to you. You wash, I'll rinse and dry." "Fine." I gave him the plate. Well, the scent was easy enough to catch. "By the way, your room reeks. I'll buy some air freshener." He laughed. I washed, and he dried in companionable silence for a few minutes. "Can I ask you something?" I handed him another plate. "That depends on what you want to know. I'm not trying to be a jerk or anything. I'm honestly curious," Jacob assured me. "Fine, go ahead." He paused for half a second. "What's it like, having a vampire for a boyfriend?" I rolled my eyes. "It's the best." "I'm serious. The idea doesn't bother you? It never creeps you out?"
"Never."
He was silent as he reached for the bowl in my hands. I peeked up at his face. He was frowning, his lower lip jutting out. "Anything else?" I asked. He wrinkled his nose again. "Well, I was wondering, do you, you know, kiss him?" I laughed. "Yes." He shuddered. "Ugh." "To each her own," I murmured. "You don't worry about the fangs?" I smacked his arm, splashing him with dishwater. "Shut up, Jacob. You know he doesn't have fangs." "Close enough," he muttered. I gritted my teeth and scrubbed a boning knife with more force than necessary. "Can I ask another one?" he asked softly, and I passed the knife to him. "Just curious again." "Fine," I snapped. He turned the knife over and over in his hands under the stream of water. When he spoke, it was only a whisper. "You said a few weeks. When exactly?" He couldn't finish. "Graduation," I whispered back, watching his face warily. Would this set him off again? "So soon," he breathed, his eyes closing. It didn't sound like a question. It sounded like a lament. The muscles in his arms tightened and his shoulders were stiff. "Ow!" he shouted. It had gotten so still in the room that I jumped a foot in the air at his outburst. His right hand had curled into a tense fist around the blade of the knife. He unclenched his hand and the knife clattered onto the counter. Across his palm was a long, deep gash. The blood streamed down his fingers and dripped on the floor. "Damn it! Ouch!" he complained. My head spun and my stomach rolled. I clung to the countertop with one hand, took a deep breath through my mouth, and forced myself to get a grip so that I could take care of him. "Oh no, Jacob! Oh, crap! Here, wrap this around it!" I shoved the dish towel at him, reaching for his hand. He shrugged away from me. "It's nothing, Bella. Don't worry about it." The room started to shimmer a little around the edges. I took another deep breath. "Don't worry! You sliced your hand open." He ignored the dish towel I pushed at him. He put his hand under the faucet and let the water wash over the wound. The water ran red. My head whirled. "Bella," he said. I looked away from the wound up to his face. He was frowning, but his expression was calm. "What? You look like you're going to pass out. And you're biting your lip off. Stop it. Relax. Breathe, I'm fine." I inhaled through my mouth and removed my teeth from my lower lip. "Don't be brave." He rolled his eyes. "Let's go. I'll drive you to the ER. I was pretty sure I would be okay to drive. The walls were holding steady now, at least. "Not necessary." Jake turned off the water and took the towel from my hand. He twisted it loosely around his palm. "Wait," I protested. "Let me look at it." I clutched the counter more firmly to hold myself upright if the wound made me woozy again. "Do you have a medical degree that you never told me about?" Just give me the chance to decide whether or not I'm going to throw a fit over taking you to the hospital. He made a face of mock horror. Please, not a fit. If you don't let me see your hand, a fit is guaranteed. He inhaled deeply and then let out a gusty sigh. Fine. He unwound the towel, and when I reached out to take the cloth, he laid his hand in mine. It took me a few seconds. I even flipped his hand over, though I was sure he'd cut his palm. I turned his hand back up, finally realizing that the angry pink puckered line was all that was left of his wound. But you were bleeding so much. He pulled his hand back, his eyes steady and somber on mine. I heal fast. I'll say, I mouthed. I'd seen the long gash clearly, seen the blood that flowed into the sink. The rust and salt smell of it had almost pulled me under. It should have needed stitches. It should have taken days to scab over and then weeks to fade into the shiny pink scar that marked his skin now. He screwed his mouth up into half a smile and thumped his fist once against his chest. Werewolf, remember? His eyes held mine for an immeasurable moment. Right, I finally said. He laughed at my expression. I told you this. You saw Paul's scar? I shook my head to clear it. It's a little different, seeing the action sequence firsthand. I kneeled down and dug the bleach out of the cabinet under the sink. Then I poured some on a dusting rag and started scrubbing the floor. The burning scent of the bleach cleared the last of the dizziness from my head. Let me clean up, Jacob said. I got this. Throw that towel in the wash, will you? When I was sure the floor smelled of nothing but bleach, I got up and rinsed the right side of the sink with bleach, too. Then I went to the laundry closet beside the pantry and poured a cupful into the washing machine before starting it. Jacob watched me with a disapproving look on his face. Do you have obsessive-compulsive disorder? He asked when I was done. Huh? Maybe. But at least I had a good excuse this time. We're a bit sensitive to blood around here. I'm sure you can understand that. Oh, he wrinkled his nose again. Why not make it as easy as possible for him? What he's doing is hard enough. Sure, sure. Why not? I pulled the plug and let the dirty water drain from the sink. Can I ask you something, Bella? I sighed. What's it like having a werewolf for a best friend? The question caught me off guard. I laughed out loud. Does it creep you out? He pressed before I could answer. No, when the werewolf is being nice, I qualified. It's the best. He grinned widely, his teeth bright against his russet skin. Thanks, Bella, he said, and then he grabbed my hand and wrenched me into one of his bone-crushing hugs. Before I had time to react, he dropped his arms and stepped away. Ugh, he said, his nose wrinkling. Your hair stinks worse than your room. Sorry, I muttered. I suddenly understood what Edward had been laughing about earlier, after breathing on me. One of the many hazards of socializing with vampires, Jacob said, shrugging. It makes you smell bad. A minor hazard, comparatively. I glared at him. I only smell bad to you, Jake. He grinned. See you round, Bells. Are you leaving? He's waiting for me to go. I can hear him outside. Oh, I'll go out the back, he said, and then he paused. Hold up a sec. Hey, do you think you can come to La Push tonight? We're having a bonfire party. Emily will be there, and you can meet Kim. And I know Quill wants to see you, too. He's pretty peeved that you found out before he did. I grinned at that. I could just imagine how that would have irked Quill, Jacob's little human gal pal down with the werewolves while he was still clueless. And then I sighed. Yeah, Jake, I don't know about that. See, it's a little tense right now. Come on, you think somebody's going to get past all six of us? There was a strange pause as he stuttered over the end of his question. I wondered if he had trouble saying the word werewolf aloud, the way I often had difficulty with vampire. His big dark eyes were full of unashamed pleading. "I'll ask," I said doubtfully. He made a noise in the back of his throat. "Is he your warden now, too? You know, I saw this story on the news last week about controlling abusive teenage relationships, and okay," I cut him off and then shoved his arm. "Time for the werewolf to get out." He grinned. "Bye, Bells. Be sure you ask permission." He ducked out the back door before I could find something to throw at him. I growled incoherently at the empty room. Seconds after he was gone, Edward walked slowly into the kitchen, raindrops glistening like diamonds set into the bronze of his hair. His eyes were wary. "Did you two get into a fight?" he asked. "Edward," I sang, throwing myself at him. "Hi there," he laughed and wrapped his arms around me. "Are you trying to distract me? It's working." "No, I didn't fight with Jacob. Much. Why?" "I was just wondering why you stabbed him. Not that I object." With his chin, he gestured to the knife on the counter. "Dang, I thought I got everything." I pulled away from him and ran to put the knife in the sink before I doused it with bleach. "I didn't stab him," I explained as I worked. "He forgot he had a knife in his hand." Edward chuckled. "That's not nearly as fun as the way I imagined it." "Be nice." He took a big envelope from his jacket pocket and tossed it on the counter. "I got your mail. Anything good?" "I think so." My eyes narrowed suspiciously at his tone. I went to investigate. He'd folded the legal-sized envelope in half. I smoothed it open, surprised at the weight of the expensive paper, and read the return address. "Dartmouth? Is this a joke?" "I'm sure it's an acceptance. It looks exactly like mine." "Good grief, Edward! What did you do?" "I sent in your application, that's all." "I may not be Dartmouth material, but I'm not stupid enough to believe that." "Dartmouth seems to think that you're Dartmouth material." I took a deep breath and counted slowly to 10. "That's very generous of them," I finally said. "However, accept it or not, there is still the minor matter of tuition. I can't afford it, and I'm not letting you throw away enough money to buy yourself another sports car just so that I can pretend to go to Dartmouth next year." "I don't need another sports car, and you don't have to pretend anything," he murmured. "One year of college wouldn't kill you. Maybe you'd even like it. Just think about it, Bella. Imagine how excited Charlie and Renee would be." His velvet voice painted the picture in my head before I could block it. Of course Charlie would explode with pride. No one in the town of Forks would be able to escape the fallout from his excitement. And Renee would be hysterical with joy at my triumph, though she'd swear she wasn't at all surprised. I tried to shake the image out of my head. "Edward, I'm worried about living through graduation, let alone this summer or next fall." His arms wrapped around me again. "No one is going to hurt you. You have all the time in the world." I sighed. "I'm mailing the contents of my bank account to Alaska tomorrow. It's all the alibi I need. It's far enough away that Charlie won't expect a visit until Christmas at the earliest, and I'm sure I'll think of some excuse by then. You know," I teased half-heartedly, "this whole secrecy and deception thing is kind of a pain." Edward's expression hardened. "It gets easier. After a few decades, everyone you know is dead. Problem solved." I flinched. "Sorry, that was harsh." I stared down at the big white envelope, not seeing it, but still true. "If I get this resolved, whatever it is we're dealing with, will you please consider waiting?" "Nope." "Always so stubborn." "Yep." The washing machine thumped and stuttered to a halt. "Stupid piece of junk," I muttered as I pulled away from him. I moved the one small towel that had unbalanced the otherwise empty machine and started it again. "This reminds me," I said. "Could you ask Alice what she did with my stuff when she cleaned my room? I can't find it anywhere." He looked at me with confused eyes. Alice cleaned your room? Yeah, I guess that's what she was doing. When she came to get my pajamas and pillow and stuff to hold me hostage, I glowered at him briefly. She picked up everything that was lying around, my shirts, my socks, and I don't know where she put them. Edward continued to look confused for one short moment, and then abruptly, he was rigid. When did you notice your things were missing? When I got back from the fake slumber party. Why? I don't think Alice took anything. Not your clothes or your pillow. The things that were taken, these were things you'd worn and touched and slept on? Yes. What is it, Edward? His expression was strained. Things with your scent. Oh. We stared into each other's eyes for a long moment. My visitor, I muttered. He was gathering traces, evidence, to prove that he'd found you. Why? I whispered. I don't know, but Bella, I swear I will find out. I will. I know you will, I said, laying my head against his chest. Leaning there, I felt his phone vibrate in his pocket. He pulled out his phone and glanced at the number. Just the person I need to talk to, he murmured, and then flipped it open. Carlyle, I... He broke off and listened, his face taut with concentration for a few minutes. I'll check it out. Listen. He explained about my missing things, but from the side I was hearing, it sounded like Carlyle had no insights for us. Maybe I'll go, Edward said, trailing off as his eyes drifted toward me. Maybe not. Don't let Emmett go alone. You know how he gets. At least ask Alice to keep an eye on things. We'll figure this out later. He snapped the phone shut. Where's the paper? He asked me. I'm not sure. Why? I need to see something. Did Charlie already throw it out? Maybe. Edward disappeared. He was back in half a second, new diamonds in his hair, a wet newspaper in his hands. He spread it out on the table, his eyes scanning quickly across the headlines. He leaned in, intent on something he was reading, one finger tracing passages that interested him most. Carlyle's right. Yes, very sloppy. Young and crazed? Or a death wish, he muttered to himself. I went to peek over his shoulder. The headline of the Seattle Times read, "Murder Epidemic Continues. Police Have No New Leads." It was almost the same story Charlie had been complaining about a few weeks ago, the big city violence that was pushing Seattle up the national murder hotspot list. It wasn't exactly the same story, though. The numbers were a lot higher. "It's getting worse," I murmured. He frowned. Altogether out of control. This can't be the work of just one newborn vampire. What's going on? It's as if they've never heard of the Volturi, which is possible, I guess. No one has explained the rules to them. So who is creating them, then? The Volturi? I repeated, shuddering. This is exactly the kind of thing they routinely wipe out. Immortals who threaten to expose us. They just cleaned up a mess like this a few years ago in Atlanta, and it hadn't gotten nearly this bad. They will intervene soon, very soon, unless we can find some way to calm the situation. I'd really rather they didn't come to Seattle just now. As long as they're this close, they might decide to check on you. I shuddered again. What can we do? We need to know more before we can decide that. Perhaps if we can talk to these young ones, explain the rules, it can be resolved peacefully. He frowned, like he didn't think the chances of that were good. We'll wait until Alice has an idea of what's going on. We don't want to step in until it's absolutely necessary. After all, it's not our responsibility. But it's good we have Jasper, he added, almost to himself. If we are dealing with newborns, he'll be helpful. Jasper? Why? Edward smiled darkly. Jasper is sort of an expert on young vampires. What do you mean, an expert? You'll have to ask him. The story is involved. What a mess, I mumbled. It does feel that way, doesn't it? Like it's coming at us from all sides these days. He sighed. Do you ever think that your life might be easier if you weren't in love with me? Maybe. It wouldn't be much of a life, though. For me, he amended quietly. And now, I suppose, he continued with a wry smile, you have something you want to ask me? I stared at him blankly. I do? Or maybe not, he grinned. I was rather under the impression that you'd promised to ask my permission to go to some kind of werewolf soiree tonight. Eavesdropping again? He grinned. Just a bit, at the very end. Well, I wasn't going to ask you anyway. I figured you had enough to stress about. He put his hand under my chin and held my face so that he could read my eyes. Would you like to go? It's no big thing. Don't worry about it. You don't have to ask my permission, Bella. I'm not your father. Thank heaven for that. Perhaps you should ask Charlie, though. But you know Charlie will say yes. I do have a bit more insight into his probable answer than most people would. It's true. I just stared at him, trying to understand what he wanted, and trying to put out of my mind the yearning I felt to go to La Push so that I wouldn't be swayed by my own wishes. It was stupid to want to go hang out with a bunch of big, idiot wolf boys right now when there was so much that was frightening and unexplained going on. Of course, that was exactly why I wanted to go. I wanted to escape the death threats for just a few hours. To be the less mature, more reckless Bella, who could laugh it off with Jacob, if only briefly. But that didn't matter. Bella, Edward said, I told you that I was going to be reasonable and trust your judgment. I meant that. If you trust the werewolves, then I'm not going to worry about them. Wow, I said, as I had last night. And Jacob's right, about one thing anyway. A pack of werewolves ought to be enough to protect even you for one evening. Are you sure? Of course, only... I braced myself. I hope you won't mind taking a few precautions, allowing me to drive you to the boundary line, for one, and then taking a cell phone so that I'll know when to pick you up. That sounds very reasonable. Excellent. He smiled at me, and I could see no trace of apprehension in his jewel-like eyes. To no one's surprise, Charlie had no problem at all with me going to La Push for a bonfire. Jacob crowed with undisguised exultation when I called to give him the news, and he seemed eager enough to embrace Edward's safety measures. He promised to meet us at the line between territories at 6. I had decided, after a short internal debate, that I would not sell my motorcycle. I would take it back to La Push where it belonged, and when I no longer needed it anymore, well then, I would insist that Jacob profit from his work somehow. He could sell it, or give it to a friend. It didn't matter to me. Tonight seemed like a good opportunity to return the bike to Jacob's garage. As gloomy as I was feeling about things lately, every day seemed like a possible last chance. I didn't have time to procrastinate any task, no matter how minor. Edward only nodded when I explained what I wanted, but I thought I saw a flicker of consternation in his eyes, and I knew he was no happier about the idea of me on a motorcycle than Charlie was. I followed him back to his house, to the garage where I'd left the bike. It wasn't until I pulled the truck in and got out that I realized the consternation might not be entirely about my safety this time. Next to my little antique motorcycle, overshadowing it, was another vehicle. To call this other vehicle a motorcycle hardly seemed fair, since it didn't seem to belong to the same family as my suddenly shabby-looking bike. It was big and sleek and silver, and even totally motionless, it looked fast. What is that? Nothing, Edward murmured. It doesn't look like nothing. Edward's expression was casual. He seemed determined to blow it off. Well, I didn't know if you were going to forgive your friend or he you, and I wondered if you would still want to ride your bike anyway. It sounded like it was something that you enjoyed. I thought I could go with you, if you wished. He shrugged. I stared at the beautiful machine. Beside it, my bike looked like a broken tricycle. I felt a sudden wave of sadness when I realized this was not a bad analogy for the way I probably look next to Edward. I wouldn't be able to keep up with you, I whispered. Edward put his hand under my chin and pulled my face around so that he could see it straight on. With one finger, he tried to push the corner of my mouth up. I'd keep pace with you, Bella. That wouldn't be much fun for you. Of course it would, if we were together. I bit my lip and imagined it for a moment. Edward, if you thought I was going too fast or losing control of the bike or something, what would you do? He hesitated, obviously trying to find the right answer. I knew the truth. He'd find some way to save me before I crashed. Then he smiled. It looked effortless, except for the tiny defensive tightening of his eyes. This is something you do with Jacob. I see that now. It's just that, well, I don't slow him down so much, you know. I could try, I guess. I eyed the silver motorcycle doubtfully. Don't worry about it, Edward said, and then he laughed lightly. I saw Jasper admiring it. Perhaps it's time he discovered a new way to travel. After all, Alice has her Porsche now. Edward, He interrupted me with a quick kiss. I said not to worry. But would you do something for me? Whatever you need, I promised quickly. He dropped my face and leaned over the far side of the big motorcycle, retrieving something he had stashed there. He came back with one object that was black and shapeless, and another that was red and easily identifiable. Please? He asked, flashing the crooked smile that always destroyed my resistance. I took the red helmet, weighing it in my hands. I'll look stupid. No, you'll look smart. Smart enough not to get yourself hurt. He threw the black thing, whatever it was, over his arm, and then took my face in his hands. There are things between my hands right now that I can't live without. You could take care of them. Okay, fine. What's the other thing? I asked suspiciously. He laughed and shook out some kind of padded jacket. It's a riding jacket. I hear road rash is quite uncomfortable. Not that I would know myself. He held it out for me. With a deep sigh, I flipped my hair back and stuffed the helmet on my head. Then I shoved my arms through the sleeves of the jacket. He zipped me in, a smile playing around the corners of his lips, and took a step back. I felt bulky. Be honest. How hideous do I look? He took another step back and pursed his lips. That bad, huh? I muttered. No. No, Bella. Actually, he seemed to be struggling for the right word. You look sexy. I laughed out loud. Right. Very sexy, really. You are just saying that so I'll wear it, I said. But that's okay. You're right. It's smarter. He wrapped his arms around me and pulled me against his chest. You're silly. I suppose that's part of your charm, though I'll admit it. This helmet does have its drawbacks. And then he pulled the helmet off so that he could kiss me. As Edward drove me toward La Push a little while later, I realized that this unprecedented situation felt oddly familiar. It took me a moment of thought to pinpoint the source of the déjà vu. You know what this reminds me of? I asked. It's just like when I was a kid and Renee would pass me up to Charlie for the summer. I feel like a 7-year-old. Edward laughed. I didn't mention it out loud, but the biggest difference between the two circumstances was that Renee and Charlie had been on better terms. About halfway to La Push, we rounded the corner and found Jacob leaning against the side of the red Volkswagen he'd built for himself out of scraps. Jacob's carefully neutral expression dissolved into a smile when I waved from the front seat. Edward parked the Volvo 30 yards away. Call me whenever you're ready to come home, he said, and I'll be here. I won't be out late, I promised. Edward pulled the bike and my new gear out of the trunk of his car. I had been quite impressed that it had all fit, but it wasn't so hard to manage when you were strong enough to juggle full-sized vans, let alone small motorcycles. Jacob watched, making no move to approach, his smile gone and his dark eyes indecipherable. I tucked the helmet under my arm and threw the jacket across the seat. "Do you have it all?" Edward asked. "No problem," I assured him. He sighed and leaned toward me. I turned my face up for a goodbye peck, but Edward took me by surprise, fastening his arms tightly around me and kissing me with as much enthusiasm as he had in the garage. Before long, I was gasping for air. Edward laughed quietly at something and then let me go. "Goodbye," he said. "I really do like the jacket." As I turned away from him, I thought I saw a flash of something in his eyes that I wasn't supposed to see. I couldn't tell for sure what it was exactly. Worry, maybe? For a second, I thought it was panic. But I was probably just making something out of nothing, as usual. I could feel his eyes on my back as I pushed my bike toward the invisible vampire-werewolf treaty line to meet Jacob. "What's all that?" Jacob called to me, his voice wary, scrutinizing the motorcycle with an enigmatic expression. "I thought I should put this back where it belongs," I told him. He pondered that for one short second, and then his wide smile stretched across his face. I knew the exact point that I was in werewolf territory, because Jacob shoved away from his car and loped quickly over to me, closing the distance in three long strides. He took the bike from me, balanced it on the kickstand, and grabbed me up in another vice-tight hug. I heard the Volvo's engine growl, and I struggled to get free. "Cut it out, Jake," I gasped breathlessly. He laughed and set me down. I turned to wave goodbye, but the silver car was already disappearing around the curve in the road. "Nice," I commented, allowing some acid to leak into my voice. His eyes widened in false innocence. "What? He's being pretty dang pleasant about this. You don't need to push your luck." He laughed again, louder than before. He found what I'd said very funny indeed. I tried to see the joke as he walked around the rabbit to hold my door open for me. "Bella," he finally said, still chuckling as he shut the door behind me. "You can't push what you don't have." Chapter 11. Legends. "Are you going to eat that hot dog?" Paul asked Jacob, his eyes locked on the last remnant of the huge meal the werewolves had consumed. Jacob leaned back against my knees and toyed with the hot dog he had spitted on a straightened wire hanger. The flames at the edge of the bonfire licked along its blistered skin. He heaved a sigh and patted his stomach. It was somehow still flat, though I'd lost count of how many hot dogs he'd eaten after his tenth, not to mention the super-sized bag of chips or the 2-liter bottle of root beer. "I guess," Jake said slowly. "I'm so full I'm about to puke, but I think I can force it down. I won't enjoy it at all, though." He sighed again sadly. Despite the fact that Paul had eaten at least as much as Jacob, he glowered and his hands balled up into fists. "Sheesh," Jacob laughed. "Kidding, Paul. Here." He flipped the homemade skewer across the circle. I expected it to land hot dog first in the sand, but Paul caught it neatly on the right end without difficulty. Hanging out with no one but extremely dexterous people all the time was going to give me a complex. "Thanks, man," Paul said, already over his brief fit of temper. The fire crackled, settling lower toward the sand. Sparks blew up in a sudden puff of brilliant orange against the black sky. Funny, I hadn't noticed that the sun had set. For the first time, I wondered how late it had gotten. I'd lost track of time completely. It was easier being with my Quileute friends than I'd expected. While Jacob and I had dropped off my bike at the garage, and he had admitted ruefully that the helmet was a good idea that he should have thought of himself, I'd started to worry about showing up with him at the bonfire, wondering if the werewolves would consider me a traitor now. Would they be angry with Jacob for inviting me? Would I ruin the party? But when Jacob had towed me out to the forest, the clifftop meeting place, where the fire already roared brighter than the cloud-obscured sun, it had all been very casual and light. "Hey, vampire girl," Embry had greeted me loudly. Quill had jumped up to give me a high five and kiss me on the cheek. Emily had squeezed my hand when we'd sat on the cool stone ground beside her and Sam. Other than a few teasing complaints, mostly by Paul, about keeping the bloodsucker stench downwind, I was treated like someone who belonged. It wasn't just kids in attendance either. Billy was here, his wheelchair stationed at what seemed the natural head of the circle. Beside him on a folding lawn chair, looking quite brittle, was Quill's ancient, white-haired grandfather, Old Quill. Sue Clearwater, widow of Charlie's friend Harry, had a chair on his other side. Her two children, Leah and Seth, were also there, sitting on the ground like the rest of us. This surprised me, but all three were clearly in on the secret now. From the way Billy and Old Quill spoke to Sue, it sounded to me like she'd taken Harry's place on the council. Did that make her children automatic members of LaPush's most secret society? I wondered how horrible it was for Leah to sit across the circle from Sam and Emily. Her lovely face betrayed no emotion, but she never looked away from the flames. Looking at the perfection of Leah's features, I couldn't help but compare them to Emily's ruined face. What did Leah think of Emily's scars, now that she knew the truth behind them? Did it seem like justice in her eyes? Little Seth Clearwater wasn't so little anymore. With his huge, happy grin and his long, gangly build, he reminded me very much of a younger Jacob. The resemblance made me smile, and then sigh. Was Seth doomed to have his life change as drastically as the rest of these boys? Was that future why he and his family were allowed to be here? The whole pack was there. Sam with his Emily, Paul, Embry, Quill, and Jared with Kim, the girl he'd imprinted upon. My first impression of Kim was that she was a nice girl, a little shy, and a little plain. She had a wide face, mostly cheekbones, with eyes too small to balance them out. Her nose and mouth were both too broad for traditional beauty. Her flat black hair was thin and wispy in the wind that never seemed to let up atop the cliff. That was my first impression, but after a few hours of watching Jared watch Kim, I could no longer find anything plain about the girl. The way he stared at her, it was like a blind man seeing the sun for the first time, like a collector finding an undiscovered Da Vinci, like a mother looking into the face of her newborn child. His wondering eyes made me see new things about her, how her skin looked like russet-colored silk in the firelight, how the shape of her lips was a perfect double curve, how white her teeth were against them, how long her eyelashes were, brushing her cheek when she looked down. Kim's skin sometimes darkened when she met Jared's awed gaze, and her eyes would drop as if in embarrassment. But she had a hard time keeping her eyes away from his for any length of time. Watching them, I felt like I better understood what Jacob had told me about imprinting before. It's hard to resist that level of commitment and adoration. Kim was nodding off now against Jared's chest, his arms around her. I imagined she would be very warm there. "It's getting late," I murmured to Jacob. "Don't start that yet," Jacob whispered back, though certainly half the group here had hearing sensitive enough to hear us anyway. "The best part is coming." "What's the best part? You swallowing an entire cow whole?" Jacob chuckled his low, throaty laugh. "No, that's the finale. We didn't meet just to eat through a week's worth of food. This is technically a council meeting. It's Quill's first time, and he hasn't heard the stories yet." "Well, he's heard them, but this will be the first time he knows they're true. That tends to make a guy pay closer attention. Kim and Seth and Leah are all first-timers, too." "Stories?" Jacob scooted back beside me, where I rested against a low ridge of rock. He put his arm over my shoulder and spoke even lower into my ear. "The histories we always thought were legends," he said. "The stories of how we came to be. The first is the story of the spirit warriors." It was almost as if Jacob's soft whisper was the introduction. The atmosphere changed abruptly around the low-burning fire. Paul and Embry sat up straighter. Jared nudged Kim and then pulled her gently upright. Emily produced a spiral-bound notebook and a pen, looking exactly like a student set for an important lecture. Sam twisted just slightly beside her so that he was facing the same direction as old Quill, who was on his other side. And suddenly I realized that the elders of the council here were not three, but four in number. Leah Clearwater, her face still a beautiful and emotionless mask, closed her eyes. Not like she was tired, but as if to help her concentration. Her brother leaned in toward the elders eagerly. The fire crackled, sending another explosion of sparks glittering up against the night. Billy cleared his throat, and with no more introduction than his son's whisper, began telling the story in his rich, deep voice. The words poured out with precision, as if he knew them by heart, but also with feeling and a subtle rhythm, like poetry performed by its author. "The Quileutes have been a small people from the beginning," Billy said, "and we are a small people still, but we have never disappeared. This is because there has always been magic in our blood. It wasn't always the magic of shape-shifting. That came later. First, we were spirit warriors." Never before had I recognized the ring of majesty that was in Billy Black's voice, though I realize now that this authority had always been there. Emily's pen sprinted across the sheets of paper as she tried to keep up with him. "In the beginning, the tribe settled in this harbor and became skilled shipbuilders and fishermen. But the tribe was small, and the harbor was rich in fish. There were others who coveted our land and were too small to hold it. A larger tribe moved against us, and we took to our ships to escape them. Kahelaha was not the first spirit warrior, but we do not remember the stories that came before his. We do not remember who was the first to discover this power, or how it had been used before this crisis. Kahelaha was the first great spirit chief in our history. In this emergency, Kahelaha used the magic to defend our land. He and all his warriors left the ship, not their bodies, but their spirits. Their women watched over the bodies and the waves, and the men took their spirits back to our harbor. They could not physically touch the enemy tribe, but they had other ways. The stories tell us that they could blow fierce winds into their enemy's camp. They could make a great screaming in the wind that terrified their foes. The stories also tell us that the animals could see the spirit warriors and understand them. The animals would do their bidding. Kahelaha took his spirit army and wreaked havoc on the intruders. This invading tribe had packs of big, thick-furred dogs that they used to pull their sleds in the frozen north. The spirit warriors turned the dogs against their masters, and then brought a mighty infestation of bats up from the cliff caverns. They used the screaming wind to aid the dogs in confusing the men. The dogs and bats won. The survivors scattered, calling our harbor a cursed place. The dogs ran wild when the spirit warriors released them. The Quileutes returned to their bodies and their wives victorious. The other nearby tribes, the Hos and the Makas, made treaties with the Quileutes. They wanted nothing to do with our magic. We lived in peace with them. When an enemy came against us, the spirit warriors would drive them off. Generations passed. Then came the last great spirit chief, Taha'aki. He was known for his wisdom and for being a man of peace. The people lived well and content in his care. But there was one man, Utlapa, who was not content. A low hiss ran around the fire. I was too slow to see where it came from. Billy ignored it and went on with the legend. Utlapa was one of Chief Taha'aki's strongest spirit warriors. A powerful man, but a grasping man, too. He thought the people should use their magic to expand their lands, to enslave the Hos and the Makas, and build an empire. Now, when the warriors were their spirit selves, they knew each other's thoughts. Taha'aki saw what Utlapa dreamed and was angry with Utlapa. Utlapa was commanded to leave the people and never use his spirit self again. Utlapa was a strong man, but the chief's warriors outnumbered him. He had no choice but to leave. The furious outcast hid in the forest nearby, waiting for a chance to get revenge against the chief. Even in times of peace, the spirit chief was vigilant in protecting his people. Often, he would go to a sacred secret place in the mountains. He would leave his body behind and sweep down through the forests and along the coast, making sure no threat approached. One day, when Taha'aki left to perform this duty, Utlapa followed. At first, Utlapa simply planned to kill the chief, but this plan had its drawbacks. Surely the spirit warriors would seek to destroy him, and they could follow faster than he could escape. As he hid in the rocks and watched the chief prepare to leave his body, another plan occurred to him. Taha'aki left his body in the secret place and flew with the winds to keep watch over his people. Utlapa waited until he was sure the chief had traveled some distance with his spirit self. Taha'aki knew it the instant that Utlapa had joined him in the spirit world, and he also knew Utlapa's murderous plan. He raced back to his secret place, but even the winds weren't fast enough to save him. When he returned, his body was already gone. Utlapa's body lay abandoned, but Utlapa had not left Taha'aki with an escape. He had cut his own body's throat with Taha'aki's hands. Taha'aki followed his body down the mountain. He screamed at Utlapa, but Utlapa ignored him as if he were mere wind. Taha'aki watched with despair as Utlapa took his place as chief of the Quileutes. For a few weeks, Utlapa did nothing but make sure that everyone believed he was Taha'aki. Then the changes began. Utlapa's first edict was to forbid any warrior to enter the spirit world. He claimed that he'd had a vision of danger, but really, he was afraid. He knew that Taha'aki would be waiting for the chance to tell his story. Utlapa was also afraid to enter the spirit world himself, knowing Taha'aki would quickly claim his body. So his dreams of conquest with a spirit warrior army were impossible, and he sought to content himself with ruling over the tribe. He became a burden, seeking privileges that Taha'aki had never requested, refusing to work alongside his warriors, taking a young second wife, and then a third, though Taha'aki's wife lived on, something unheard of in the tribe. Taha'aki watched in helpless fury. Eventually, Taha'aki tried to kill his body to save the tribe from Utlapa's excesses. He brought a fierce wolf down from the mountains, but Utlapa hid behind his warriors. When the wolf killed a young man who was protecting the false chief, Taha'aki felt horrible grief. He ordered the wolf away. All the stories tell us that it was no easy thing to be a spirit warrior. It was more frightening than exhilarating to be freed from one's body. This is why they only use their magic in times of need. The chief's solitary journeys to keep watch were a burden and a sacrifice. Being bodiless was disorienting, uncomfortable, horrifying. Taha'aki had been away from his body for so long at this point that he was in agony. He felt he was doomed, never to cross over to the final land where his ancestors waited, stuck in this torturous nothingness forever. The great wolf followed Taha'aki's spirit as he twisted and writhed in agony through the woods. The wolf was very large for its kind and beautiful. Taha'aki was suddenly jealous of the dumb animal. At least it had a body. At least it had life. Even life as an animal would be better than this horrible, empty consciousness. And then Taha'aki had the idea that changed us all. large for its kind and beautiful. Ta'aki was suddenly jealous of the dumb animal. At least it had a body. At least it had life. Even life as an animal would be better than this horrible, empty consciousness. And then Ta'aki had the idea that changed us all. He asked the great wolf to make room for him, to share. The wolf complied. Ta'aki entered the wolf's body with relief and gratitude. It was not his human body, but it was better than the void of the spirit world. As one, the man and the wolf returned to the village on the harbor. The people ran in fear, shouting for the warriors to come. The warriors ran to meet the wolf with their spears. Utlapa, of course, stayed safely hidden. Ta'aki did not attack his warriors. He retreated slowly from them, speaking with his eyes and trying to yelp the songs of his people. The warriors began to realize that the wolf was no ordinary animal, that there was a spirit influencing it. One older warrior, a man named Ute, decided to disobey the false chief's orders and try to communicate with the wolf. As soon as Ute crossed to the spirit world, Ta'aki left the wolf. The animal waited tamely for his return to speak to him. Ute gathered the truth in an instant and welcomed his true chief home. At this time, Utlapa came to see if the wolf had been defeated. When he saw Ute lying lifeless on the ground, surrounded by protective warriors, he realized what was happening. He drew his knife and raced forward to kill Ute before he could return to his body. "Traitor!" he screamed, and the warriors did not know what to do. The chief had forbidden spirit journeys, and it was the chief's decision how to punish those who disobeyed. Ute jumped back into his body, but Utlapa had his knife at his throat and a hand covering his mouth. Ta'aki's body was strong, and Ute was weak with age. Ute could not say even one word to warn the others before Utlapa silenced him forever. Ta'aki watched as Ute's spirit slipped away to the final lands that were barred to Ta'aki for all eternity. He felt a great rage, more powerful than anything he'd felt before. He entered the big wolf again, meaning to rip Utlapa's throat out. But as he joined the wolf, the greatest magic happened. Ta'aki's anger was the anger of a man. The love he had for his people and the hatred he had for their oppressor were too vast for the wolf's body, too human. The wolf shuddered, and before the eyes of the shocked warriors and Utlapa, transformed into a man. The new man did not look like Ta'aki's body. He was far more glorious. He was the flesh interpretation of Ta'aki's spirit. The warriors recognized him at once, though, for they had flown with Ta'aki's spirit. Utlapa tried to run, but Ta'aki had the strength of the wolf in his new body. He caught the thief and crushed the spirit from him before he could jump out of the stolen body. The people rejoiced when they understood what had happened. Ta'aki quickly set everything right, working again with his people and giving the young wives back to their families. The only change he kept in place was the end of the spirit travels. He knew that it was too dangerous now that the idea of stealing a life was there. The spirit warriors were no more. From that point on, Ta'aki was more than either wolf or man. They called him Ta'aki the Great Wolf, or Ta'aki the Spirit Man. He led the tribe for many, many years, for he did not age. When danger threatened, he would resume his wolf self to fight or frighten the enemy. The people dwelt in peace. Ta'aki fathered many sons, and some of these found that after they reached the age of manhood, they too could transform into wolves. The wolves were all different because they were spirit wolves and reflected the man they were inside. "So that's why Sam is all black," Quill muttered under his breath, grinning. "Black heart, black fur." I was so involved in the story, it was a shock to come back to the present, to the circle around the dying fire. With another shock, I realized that the circle was made up of Taha'aki's great, to however many degrees, grandsons. The fire threw a volley of sparks into the sky, and they shivered and danced, making shapes that were almost decipherable. "And your chocolate fur reflects what?" Sam whispered back to Quill. "How sweet you are!" Billy ignored their jibes. Some of the sons became warriors with Taha'aki, and they no longer aged. Others who did not like the transformation refused to join the pack of wolfmen. These began to age again, and the tribe discovered that the wolfmen could grow old like anyone else if they gave up their spirit wolves. Taha'aki had lived the span of 3 old men's lives. He had married a 3rd wife after the deaths of the 1st 2, and found in her his true spirit wife. Though he had loved the others, this was something else. He decided to give up his spirit wolf so that he would die when she did. That is how the magic came to us, but it is not the end of the story. He looked at old Quill Atera, who shifted in his chair, straightening his frail shoulders. Billy took a drink from a bottle of water and wiped his forehead. Emily's pen never hesitated as she scribbled furiously on the paper. "That was the story of the spirit warriors," old Quill began in a thin tenor voice. "This is the story of the 3rd wife's sacrifice. Many years after Taha'aki gave up his spirit wolf, when he was an old man, trouble began in the north with the Makahs. Several young women of their tribe had disappeared, and they blamed it on the neighboring wolves, who they feared and mistrusted. The wolfmen could still read each other's thoughts while in their wolf forms, just like their ancestors had while in their spirit forms. They knew that none of their number was to blame. Taha'aki tried to pacify the Makah chief, but there was too much fear. Taha'aki did not want to have a war on his hands. He was no longer a warrior to lead his people. He charged his oldest wolf son, Tahawi, with finding the true culprit before hostilities began. Tahawi led the 5 other wolves in his pack on a search through the mountains, looking for any evidence of the missing Makahs. They came across something they had never encountered before, a strange sweet scent in the forest that burned their noses to the point of pain. I shrank a little closer to Jacob's side. I saw the corner of his mouth twitch with humor, and his arm tightened around me. They did not know what creature would leave such a scent, but they followed it, old Quill continued. His quavering voice did not have the majesty of Billy's, but it had a strange, fierce edge of urgency about it. My pulse jumped as his words came faster. They found faint traces of human scent and human blood along the trail. They were sure this was the enemy they were searching for. The journey took them so far north that Taha'aki sent half the pack, the younger ones, back to the harbor to report to Taha'aki. Taha'aki and his 2 brothers did not return. The younger brothers searched for their elders, but found only silence. Taha'aki mourned for his sons. He wished to avenge his son's death, but he was old. He went to the Makah chief in his mourning clothes and told him everything that had happened. The Makah chief believed his grief, and tensions ended between the tribes. A year later, 2 Makah maidens disappeared from their homes on the same night. The Makahs called on the Quileute wolves at once, who found the same sweet stink all through the Makah village. The wolves went on the hunt again. Only one came back. He was Yaha'uta, the oldest son of Taha'aki's 3rd wife, and the youngest in the pack. He brought something with him that had never been seen in all the days of the Quileutes. A strange, cold, stony corpse that he carried in pieces. All who were of Taha'aki's blood, even those who had never been wolves, could smell the piercing smell of the dead creature. This was the enemy of the Makahs. Yaha'uta described what had happened. He and his brothers had found the creature, who looked like a man, but was hard as a granite rock, with the 2 Makah daughters. One girl was already dead, white and bloodless on the ground. The other was in the creature's arms, his mouth at her throat. She may have been alive when they came upon the hideous scene, but the creature quickly snapped her neck and tossed her lifeless body to the ground when they approached. His white lips were covered in her blood, and his eyes glowed red. Yahu'uta described the fierce strength and speed of the creature. One of his brothers quickly became a victim when he underestimated that strength. The creature ripped him apart like a doll. Yahu'uta and his other brother were more wary. They worked together, coming at the creature from the sides, outmaneuvering it. They had to reach the very limits of their wolf's strength and speed, something that had never been tested before. The creature was hard as stone and cold as ice. They found that only their teeth could damage it. They began to rip small pieces of the creature apart while it fought them. But the creature learned quickly, and soon was matching their maneuvers. It got its hands on Yahu'uta's brother. Yahu'uta found an opening on the creature's throat, and he lunged. His teeth tore the head off the creature, but the hands continued to mangle his brother. Yahu'uta ripped the creature into unrecognizable chunks, tearing pieces apart in a desperate attempt to save his brother. He was too late, but in the end, the creature was destroyed. Or so they thought. Yahu'uta laid the reeking remains out to be examined by the elders. One severed hand lay beside a piece of the creature's granite arm. The two pieces touched when the elders poked them with sticks, and the hand reached out towards the arm piece, trying to reassemble itself. Horrified, the elders set fire to the remains. A great cloud of choking, vile smoke polluted the air. When there was nothing but ashes, they separated the ashes into many small bags and spread them far and wide. Some in the ocean, some in the forest, some in the cliff caverns.